Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 75, we're at the European Parliament here in Brussels, where we'll be asking if the future of Belgium is set to be a divided or a united one.
Whether we disagree or not, we need to keep on negotiating as long as needed so that we can finally find a solution to the problem.
That was Pierre Verkouteren, professor of politics at Leuven Academic University. And as Eurostar's competitors begin their first test runs through the Channel Tunnel, we'll be discussing what the future landscape of European rail travel will look like.
10, 15 years from now, you look on a map and you see, oh, wonderful high-speed network, but it's just for Western Europe and nothing for Eastern Europe.
That was Johannes Ludewig, executive director of CER, the Community of European Railway and Infrastructure Companies. And later in the program, we'll be talking to Witold Szablowski, one of the winners of this week's prestigious European Parliament Prize for Journalism.
It's very easy to talk about Europe, very easy to talk about immigrants when you sit on a comfortable chair in Brussels.
And now, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 17th, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Brussels. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, very good to see you.
What did you do with Rob Bound?
Well, actually,
did you leave him on the carousel at the airport?
I'm not quite sure how he's doing, actually, because I've just spent a bit of this week trying to keep up with him at Frieze, which is obviously a festival of art, but it's a festival of going out in the evening as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of champagne sponsorship, I believe.
I think Rob is sponsored by a champagne house, actually. he's got his own sponsors after this week. A champagne house, a vodka house, and a beer house.
He's got his own overalls.
He's got everything.
Well, don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be talking to Rob Bound a little bit later in the program. Andrew, how's your week been? Aside from babysitting Rob Bound, of course.
Apart from babysitting him. So it's been kind of Frieze evenings and nice kind of office-bound days, and then kind of a journey across in the Eurostar to join you here in Brussels.
I think there should be a drink, a Frieze.
A Frieze. I've certainly been freezing all week.
And journey was over, it was nice. We'll be talking a little bit about railway a little bit later in the program, but journey was fine.
Yeah, it's fine. I live very near St. Pancras, so I'm always kind of
Can you walk?
Yes, I did walk.
Oh.
I can walk in general, and I can walk to the station.
I almost walked from Munich. That's what it felt like today.
Well, the funny thing is also when you get here, there's a bit of a walk as well.
There's a bit of a walk. No, but I started my day in Munich, and I just made it to the airport in time. And it's good that you've got those sort of mobile check-in things so you can, just use your, BlackBerry or whatever you happen to travel with. And but of course, I got there just in the nick of time. And it said, that it was gate number G3. And of course, I was at sort of G65 when I walked through. So had to sort of have my two carry-ons, take them all the way there. Then we had quite a long fog delay to get here. And then Brussels Airport, I was just wandering through and I was thinking, I wonder if sort of Brussels Airport is sort of a commentary for the rest of this country, maybe.
It's not good, I take it.
Well, it's not great. I mean, it's, we do talk about airports, from time to time, really being the gateway. They are these structures of first impressions. And, I think once you go from gate G75 there all the way to the taxi, you think, there could be some problems here.
But it's funny, actually, when you arrive on the train, it's a very kind of uneventful arrival in the way you kind of get tipped off, and then you kind of walk down a spiral staircase and you end up on the...
Which is always convenient.
Yeah, and then you kind of end up on the edge of kind of like a shopping mall. It's not... So Brussels maybe not that excited about you coming here.
No, I don't think they are, no.
Actually, we like the EU Parliament. They've been nice of them to have us, but it is from the security check-in to where our studio is being... A good 10-minute walk.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a journey. So no one needs to go running after the program today. That's for sure. No, because I think it's an interesting town. We get a lot of comment from our readers in Belgium whenever we do our quality of life survey. And on one side, I think people sometimes feel like we don't even we completely ignore Brussels, which is not the case. We've looked at Brussels for the last 4 years. It always does reasonably well, but it never quite makes it. And likewise, Antwerp is a lovely. It's a lovely city, but it's almost verging on being a town in a way as well. It's very, very hard. I mean, it's hard enough to compare Copenhagen to Tokyo, but then even to sort of, put an Antwerp against a Munich or Berlin is perhaps not so fair.
Yeah, and I think often when people write to us and say, why isn't Brussels in there, they do comment on it being small, and oddly that isn't enough really for it to kind of win through on the kind of quality of life stuff, I think. But there are a lot of people who like this town because it isn't Paris. It's a little bit more manageable to get around. They want a kind of a manageable kind of town, but that isn't a kind of enough to kind of win through on our kind of urbanism metrics, unfortunately.
No, should we talk about Brand Belgium?
Let's talk about Brand Belgium.
Absolutely. Well, Belgium's parliament returned to work last Tuesday, with the main order of business being to break an ongoing political deadlock and form a new government. But 4 months after the last general election, the rift between politicians sitting in the Flemish and French-speaking camps only seems to be widening. Are we set to see another record-breaking squabble before a new government materializes? Or will the nation move one step closer to permanently splitting in two? Pierre Verkouteren is professor of politics at Leuven Academic University, and he joins us here in the studio. I guess to start, I mean, how do you solve a problem like Belgium? Could this literally be a full-time job round the clock for a number of different consultancies? Maybe it is already.
It's literally a full-time job indeed, especially as we have a kind of prison break system, meaning that each time you have the feeling that we are reaching the end of the story, then suddenly there is a new kind of new episode in the story. So indeed, it's a full-time job.
Mm. In the last quarter of 2010, what would you say is the new episode and what will be the next chapter probably written next year? If you could look into a crystal ball.
Back to negotiation table again. I mean, we have two alternatives. First, to give early elections, but as we are just leaving elections last May or last June, it's going to be a bit too premature, and I'm not sure that everyone is ready except the NVE and NVA, who is scoring high in opinion polls. But for the other parties, I think most of them want to remain on track, and then that's the other alternative. Whether we disagree or not, we need to keep on negotiating as long as needed so that we can finally find a solution to the problem.
I mean, if you went and asked the man or woman on the street, if you're in Brussels, you went to Ghent, you went to Antwerp, I mean, what is really the national sentiment in people's hearts? Do they want to see a Flemish flag at the next Olympics, or do they still want to see the tricolour of Belgium, do you think?
The wide majority is still, and that's also confirmed in the latest opinion polls. Even in Flanders, the wide majority of people still want to keep Belgium. The problem is, what kind of Belgium do we want to keep? From the French-speaking side, they want to keep a kind of strong federal system, although further devolution of powers to regions and communities. But from the Flemish side, they want to reverse the logic and to say the main point on regions and communities, and then residual competences to the federal level. That's quite far apart.
And because, you know, when one looks at any international media, you travel around the world, it's interesting to also just, I mean, see the jockeying for power that you have between Wallonia, you know, looking for, you know, their own investments and people coming into the region, as much as you see the same for Flanders as well. That alone, maybe you could frame it for us. I'm wondering, does it still filter up to a federal level, though? Who comes in, where it goes, or is it really sort of up for grabs between the two Belgiums at the moment?
It depends on the field you're talking about. When you're talking about investments, indeed, these are powers of the regions. So indeed, all around the world, they are just trying to sell their own business. But when you're talking, for instance, about foreign policies, about security policies, etc., then you have on the federal level, and then there is no problem at all.
Mm. What does, I mean, certainly from your opinion and sitting at Leuven University, do you have a prescription? What you think, and certainly when you debate and thrash these things out, what would be the best outcome, do you think?
The best outcome would be first a system, although with further devolution of powers, because it's requested from the Flemish and the French-speaking side as well. But second, a stable system. And also the third condition would be to have still a strong coordination, a compulsory coordination between the various regions and communities in order to avoid a splitting apart. It's a bit like in a couple. The less you talk to one another, the less you have something to say, to tell to one another. And then suddenly you say, well, we have nothing more to say to one another, and then we get divorced. And that would be the main danger, I think, for the future of Belgium.
Are there any benchmarks anywhere else, whether we look within a European context or anywhere else in the world, that you think there's a potential model that could be followed here, whether it's historically or in a contemporary setting, do you think?
I'm not sure there's a possible benchmark, because this is a very original process. When you have a unitary state, gradually, with more and more devolution of power, this is different from Switzerland, for instance, when they are more and more integrated. So it's very hard to find a point of comparison with this.
I wondered, what are the social stories that bind people together here? If people are very divided in the, you know, into two halves of the country, if they don't mix very much unless it's within the context of somewhere like Brussels, what are the things that actually have stopped it falling apart until now? Is there a kind of national story that still is glue between both sides?
The glue before was that there was a kind of objective alliance between the northern and the southern part to transform the unitary state towards a federal state. This kind of alliance ended in 1995, where we had a new constitution, a federal kingdom, but then it was supposed to be that with each part full of new powers, they would take their own initiative to cooperate with one another, which they did not. So it leads gradually to more and more foreign countries. Now that is indeed a strong problem. I think most of the people still want to keep things this way. It's a solution of compromise, and they say maybe split it apart, it would be much more expensive than remaining together.
I was just on a social level. Do you think that there, you know, is there, for example, a sporting hero that's loved on both sides? Do both sides love the same authors, or is there a kind of a food culture that's shared? It's quite hard to see what's actually.
It's a kind of general mentality of people, a mentality of compromise, mentality of middle way, not extreme right or extreme left, although there is some traces in the electorate. Maybe the common history that most during those last 10 centuries, Belgium was a battlefield of Europe rather than an independent country. So I think the central part, the political system, is not the federal or the region states. These are the communes, and these are the most important part for the people.
I guess, so in summary, it sort of sounds like it's sort of a better the devil you know is perhaps sort of the strongest glue for the moment anyway.
It's a bit like this, yes. Although I think that's a part of Belgium's surrealism. They say, well, of course, rationally, things should split apart. But people are able to live with it and to relativize the seriousness of the situation and say, well, they are talking a lot, they are politicians. But with one another, they are... well, hand in glove with each other, in a sense.
Professor Pierre Vergouderen, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And isn't so often the case, you look at somewhere, like Belgium, and it can have, all of this, this infighting. And of course, it seems to sort of, always be going on and almost has, as many new leaders as Japan does. But part of the thing is it can do it because it is so stable in a way, like a Japan. It just, just soldiers on.
It is interesting that you realize that actually so much government has actually already been devolved or kind of sent to the regions, that actually they don't really need that much central government. So while the bickering goes on in parliament, actually the Belgians are very good at kind of running their country. They keep it prosperous. They keep it stable, as you say. And it isn't somewhere that you imagine them coming out on the street for kind of a revolution to divide the country. If this country ever does get torn in two, it'll be done over kind of paperwork and a beer, probably.
Any thoughts of moving here?
Not tempted yet, but that's nothing against Belgium.
I didn't want to put you on the spot.
I just don't see any reason quite yet to kind of move permanently from London to here. I'll let someone else man the Brussels bureau. Okay. Although, actually, can I just say that it's amazing when you look at all the kind of the people who've come here as correspondents to Brussels, how many of them actually do end up staying for quite a long time. So I think it's quite a seducing place to stay if you want to kind of see the rest of Europe and things, or if you want to be, you feel kind of quite connected, I guess, if you're a journalist.
Yeah, and I think also just, proximity, to Germany, France, of course, being incredibly close as well, coast not far away, and even go to London.
I know, not far away, two hours.
Exactly. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in Brussels, back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Brussels. This week, Deutsche Bahn's ICE3 train will make its maiden test voyage to London's St. Pancras Station, the first non-Eurostar train to venture through the Channel Tunnel. Other operators, including a consortium involving Air France and a budget Italian railway company, are also gearing up to take advantage of newly liberalized competition rules. Is Eurostar's monopoly soon set to be toppled, and how will the future landscape of continental rail travel change over the coming years? Johannes Ludewig is the executive director of CER, the Community of Europe European railway and infrastructure companies here in Brussels, and he joins us here in studio. Willkommen.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I would like to start just to maybe paint a bit of a picture. When we look at a more liberalized Europe, do you see, you know, maybe a three-tier system where we're going to have trains that can carry 5,000 people because they're going to be operated, you know, not unlike a Ryanair or an EasyJet? You know, will we be able to see, you know, Italian operators go all the way from Milan to London overnight? Briefly, what's it going to look like?
Well, I think we will see a lot of, I think, more traffic of this kind in the future. It is very attractive. People compare that with going to airports, having all these security checks, and then sitting a little bit very tight to their neighbor in a plane. And our experience is that people get on a train if the travel time is not longer than three and a half hours. So it depends which distance you can cover, I think, within this time frame. So if you have a high-speed train, you can go up to, let's say, 1,000 kilometers. This is a relevant, I think, distance for at least trips which you're doing during the day.
The test that Deutsche Bahn is going to be conducting, is that really sort of, perhaps sort of the first sort of serious challenge? And does it surprise you? And I guess in the interest of full disclosure, you're an ex-Deutsche Bahn man yourself. Is this really sort of the territory? And does it surprise you that they said, you know, we want to go after the Channel Tunnel first?
No, it's a logic, you know, because the attractive thing for high-speed traffic is to link really big cities, agglomerations, you know. If you look around in Europe, you know, okay, here in Western Europe, it's clear London is one of those places, you know. So it's attractive to link that, you know. The same with Paris, you know. In Germany, we're a little bit more spread. We have not just one big city and agglomeration. So this is attractive, and so it's absolutely been logic, you know, to go, I think, to see how to link London, I think, to this network of services.
Who else emerges next? I mean, is it probably quite clear that SBB also then becomes, you know, a bigger player, as obviously, you know, Swiss Federal Railways, just given, obviously, a lot of people like to go to Switzerland and benchmark their network. Do we see them also becoming probably another big player as well?
I cannot speak for the Swiss, but I think we have seen recently that the Swiss have agreed a contract or a kind of cooperation agreement with the Germans. So it seems more that they try to organize it in a cooperative way with Deutsche Bahn. That is what my impression. And it's also like in any other business, you have a mixture of competition and cooperation. You see, the Germans and the French railways are running together the services between Paris and Frankfurt. Even interesting in the Thales system, you have German, Deutsche Bahn have also a certain share. But nevertheless, they're running their own trains in parallel, you know. Mm. So you can see this is a market which is developing, and we will see certainly interesting new services in the future.
Do you think it's going to lead to a kind of raising of standards? Because I wonder whether some of the national kind of brands at the moment, they do quite well because, you know, they have the loyalty of their own kind of people, their own nationalities. Once we start seeing kind of German trains running to the UK, do you think it will put pressure on British operators to improve their services? Do you think you will see a kind of improvement in, say, French railways?
Well, I think this is people are much more, I think my experience is at least, people are much more objective, open to new services, and they don't ask too much, is that German or French or British, you know. So ICE-3 has the advantage to be a relatively recent train compared to many, for example, TGV is still running, I think, today. You know, the French have started earlier, I think, with their high-speed services. So a substantial part of the rolling stock is older, for example, than the ICE-3. So it's normal if an ICE-3 is running somewhere that people, I think, find that attractive. Mm. The French have bought already, and this will go on service, I think, relatively soon. The next generation, I think, of TGV is coming from Alstom, you know. So that will then be the next step. People will certainly find that very attractive. So there's a certain competition also, I think, by the quality of rolling stock you can offer. You know?
And do you think there would be ever a case where kind of a national carrier, say like Spain, would actually run services not even connecting to Spain, that they'd be interested in just running, say, a Berlin-Vienna route or another very, you know, a route that they thought they could make money on, that they would just literally move trains there to make money?
Yes, I can imagine. Whether they are moving trains, that remains to be seen, or whether they would simply buy rolling stock, which is more suited, I think, to this link they want to serve, you know. But I think this, absolutely, and I could imagine that other, even including maybe even the Japanese or others, you know, who are saying, okay, there's an attractive link or attractive, I think, distance here to cover. Why not getting into this business? I think the problem, which why we don't see more than that, is that the profit margins, what the money you can actually earn, is limited, because long-distance passenger traffic always competes with road and airplanes. So that keeps the prices. You cannot afford, I think, to raise the prices beyond a certain limit. And that explains that even in countries where long distance traveling on rail, I think there is free access, like in Germany. Everybody can every day get on the network and offer services. And not very many companies have done that. And this is the explanation that and I know that from my time when I was CEO of Deutsche Bahn, you know, that in long distance passenger rail services, at least up to now, you cannot earn that much money because of that very tight competitive situation.
Just you know, as much as I like Munich Airport and I like Lufthansa some days, you know, getting up at 4 o'clock this morning to get here, it would have been much nicer if I could have just gone to the Hauptbahnhof and jumped on an overnight service that was in many ways everything that you would expect from staying in a a decent to good hotel. I'm wondering, do you think, just because of, and even before we went on air, we were talking about just the hassles that you have with airports right now, do you think that there's room, or will we certainly see, you know, a bigger boom in overnight travel because just people don't want to get up early? And, you know, you're just saving time overnight, you know, within a confined territory like Europe.
Well, you know, if you see the recent development over the last, let's say, 10 years, you have seen a really dramatic decline in overnight services, you know. Although they were a relatively comfortable service, but for example, between Brussels and Warsaw, Brussels and Milano, you know, all this has been cancelled, you know, also Brussels, Berlin. Because obviously people prefer, I think, getting nevertheless, even if it's late in the evening or early in the morning, simply to do that in 1 or 1.5 hours. And this is simply the experience of the railways. Maybe we still have to try again, I think, if you can do that with a higher degree of comfort or whatever. But there have been several attempts, I think, in this respect and over the last 10, 20 years, and they have not been extremely successful. You remember, for example, Deutsche Bahn, they have overnight services. They have relaunched that, I think, I remember, about 15 years ago. And this was partly successful, but not really that you would say, okay, it's really worthwhile to invest a lot of money into that.
When we look at boards, you know, when you walk into a big station, you know, if we think sort of 2 years from now, I mean, are we really going to see, you know, if we're at Gare du Nord in Paris, if we're at the Hauptbahnhof in Berlin, you know, something which almost resembles, you know, nothing different than being at an airport, that you're seeing really myriad different types of operators at a certain point. I mean, you know, four people competing on the exact same line, and that same type of also service shakedown as well, low cost carriers, three class services, only first class services. Where do you think it will go?
No, I think this will be limited, as I said, at least in the first place, to really links between the big agglomerations, because there you have enough, I think, customers, and you can organize something, a service, let's say, one train every hour. So that is really what makes things unattractive, you know, and it's really much better than what the airlines can offer, you know.
But 2 to 3 players on that route, do you think, on the same, let's say it is Berlin-Munich, for example, could you have 3 or 4 competitors on that same line?
As I said, the margins, and don't forget that the margins, I think, at least for the time being, are very small. And this, I have some doubts whether you can really attract very many companies who are ready to invest a lot of capital, I think, just for very small profit margins. So I think on many lines, we will see 1 or 2 maybe. And on the really attractive one, as I said, if you go London, Brussels, and then down the Rhine Valley, you know, to the south, and so where you have really one bigger agglomeration after the other one, that is certainly extremely attractive. Or in Italy, you know, between Milano, you know, and Rome, yeah, or Torino, you know, and Rome. And in France, as it has developed, I think this is certainly also Deutsche Bahn. I think they have announced that they also want to offer a service going down to Marseille, you know. So this is something. By the way, in this respect, it's still open whether in cooperation with SNCF or not, we will see that, you know. So I think there's certainly a market. People like that, you know. But you need really a sufficient number of customers. So and the problem is in European Union, the further you get to the east, you know, the density of the population decreases dramatically, you know. And this is a political problem, what we see, that the high-speed services are developing, I think, very nicely in Western Europe. But we don't see anything in Eastern Europe. And if I imagine that in, let's say, 10, 15 years from now, you look on a map and you see, oh, wonderful high-speed network, but it's just for Western Europe and nothing for Eastern Europe, this would be politically, I think, something really for the European Commission to think about. this is something what we should not, I think, support. I mean, we should support the development of high speed, but we should think about a good way, I think, to connect at least to a minimum extent, I think, the Eastern European major capitals like Warsaw and others, Prague, you know, to this network.
Great. Mr. Ludwig, thank you very much for joining us. I have to go back to what I was saying earlier. I mean, just one more time. I think we have to have a go at establishing a European high-speed overnight rail network, because as Mr. Ludwig was saying, you know, a lot of people have tried it, but I just don't think they've quite got it. And in fact, I did look at taking a train from Munich, and I think as far as I could go was Cologne, and then sort of getting on another train didn't sort of make a lot of sense in the morning. But there seems to be, I would try. I think I would use it.
What would tempt you to actually spend maybe 8 hours coming here rather than kind of 2 hours?
Well, I think if I could actually use my sleeping time. So particularly this has been a week of, where have I been? You know, it's been Helsinki, it's been Stockholm, it's been Geneva, it's been Frankfurt, and then it was on to Stuttgart, and then to Munich. So it is one of those weeks where, you end up having a business dinner and just think, actually, I wouldn't mind going to the main station, getting into a nice, well-appointed rail carriage, going into a nice room, cup of cocoa waiting for me. And of course, ensuring that, you didn't have to go into the station for a shower, but you could have a shower and then just, be at your destination the next morning, I think would be. I'm not a huge fan of the schlep out to the airport, particularly in mornings. I mean, who is?
No, I guess that's the thing that the trains haven't quite cracked, isn't it? Is having like a great onboard shower or just letting you get off the train, and that's what they should have to their advantage. It should be really possible to feel kind of really spruced up for the day, well slept, as you said, and also have kind of all the technology now around you that you need for your business day.
Yeah, I was feeling a bit ratty this morning when I arrived here. Did you notice that?
Well, it took a little bit of warming up. I was scared to put my hand in the cage at the beginning, but...
It's all fine now.
Okay, good.
Exactly. I've been fed and watered. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Brussels. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Brussels and now London, where it's time for culture with Robert Bound. Hello, Rob.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, actually. I've survived freeze week, which is always it's always nice to find myself at the end of the week in one piece.
It's Sunday morning, though. Surely there must be some, brunch or something else that you can find your way to, no?
Yes, I think I'm sure there's people. I'm sure the streets are kind of full of bedraggled people and still in their heels and party frocks from the last few nights, kind of trying to find their way home. But my brunch is going to be served in bed this morning, I think.
Well, Rob, I felt like a very odd kind of like mother or going out with you for the early evening parts of this week, just kind of then letting you loose for the later part. But it was an amazing week, wasn't it? I was really amazed at the number of events on, the amount of kind of artists who had come into town, the buyers who are here. It felt very vibrant. Didn't you think?
Yeah, it felt really vibrant, and I think also there were lots of sort of performance things this year. So lots of things for people to really see and sort of be involved in. Our friend Marina Abramovich, who's in our last issue, was in town and caused quite a stir. She's got a big personality. We saw her right at the beginning of the week at the Tate Modern, and just when she turned up to the AOA exhibition, it seemed to suddenly be an art event as if it wasn't already. So all sorts of faces and amusing parties, and I'm sure the odd broken high heel as well somewhere amongst it all.
Rob, I thought why don't we do a little bit of music first, and then we'll come back and talk about sort of freeze in the broader context of London. And do you have anything nice on your playlist this week?
I've got something that maybe doesn't suit my morning this morning, but you're in Brussels. You might need something a little bit more. You might need something energetic, I thought. This has no link to Brussels. It's by a Texan rapper called Danny.
Are you walking around? I just got a picture of you sort of, walking around to turn this on. And I just feel that you're probably just in your pants in your kitchen right now. Am I far off?
You're not that far off, but I'm wearing a nice warm jumper. It's chilly. Come on.
Good.
So do you want to get down with Danny?
Let's do it.
Here he is. Never hawk my wares up on OK Player. The kids got the juice and the OJ flavor. OJ for mayor, cause I'm killing this rap shit. White Bronco flow, the glove and the mask fit. Somebody call the law before Danny go bash it on accident. Get on down. Get on down. Na, 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 na. so, Sammy.
Well, that was very Sunday morning. I'm not sure if it's what we needed in Brussels either, but anyway.
Something to, you know, wipe your pate plate with. I thought that was silly.
Yeah, thanks for reaching into your stack. It's interesting what you're saying about Fries, and I missed it, but it just sounds, you know, based on Hugo's reports from London's Design Week, was just about sort of just, you know, being, you know, more is more. This almost sounds, you know, in terms of, at least from a cultural perspective, was quite good for brand London.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think people who every year, you know, and since the crash, I think every year people are kind of like, oh, you know, and when people are trying to look at, you know, people are obviously trying to peer over people's shoulders as they're signing the checks in the booths, you know, at the art fair, trying to see how many zeros are going on the end of that check. And I think perhaps this year there was maybe a zero missing off some of the checks. But I think there was, as Andrew was saying, there was a phenomenal exuberance to it. You know, it felt like a real sort of party week and a real celebration of things. People sometimes regard London as just being a stop off between the amazing art market of New York and the burgeoning art market of the East, but actually, you know, London's got a phenomenal scene of its own, and I know where people would rather sort of hang out and drink a glass of champagne while they write that check, and it's London.
Andrew and Rob, did either of you see anything for your front garden or for your kitchen walls that you'd want to purchase?
I got an ironic garden gnome for the front garden. And Andrew's always flexing his plastic at the free park, aren't you, Andrew?
Well, I thought this year was the funny year because lots of people ended up with a piece of art when they shouldn't have, because the people that went to the Ai Weiwei, it's these 100 million little kind of porcelain seeds. And throughout the rest of Fries Week, every time I kind of caught out of the corner of my eye people talking to each other, they were surreptitiously showing each other their seeds in their pockets. So they'd all been kind of nicking them at the private view.
Right.
Yeah, it was. It's like a take-home thing. And at the art fair, David Shrigley, the sort of cartoonist, was doing tattoos at the Stephen Friedman stand. So people would queue up and you'd have a piece of a work of art that basically lasts for 5 or 6 months. It's sort of non-permanent, but still quite permanent. So be careful where you have it, tattoos, which were quite cool in his sort of signature style. So there were things to take home for free.
Rob, we're going to let you go because I imagine you're getting a chill and you should probably put some trousers on.
I should definitely get in the bath.
All right. Well, I think it also it's time for you to catch your boat to Hamburg, I believe, as well.
Yes, exactly. That'll be next week. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, have a good Sunday. See you soon.
Bye, Rob.
Okay. Thanks, Tyler.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Brussels. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Brussels. Earlier in the week, the winners of the European Parliament's annual prize for excellence in journalism were announced. Scouring the continent in search of standout stories, the jury awarded Swedish Radio for a critical investigation on EU funding in Turkey, a documentary on the history of the EU made for MTV Hungary, and a British blogger for an article examining how many national laws derive from the EU. Riveting stuff. The winner in the print category was Witold Szablowski of the Polish daily Gazeta Wyborcza for his article on the problem of illegal immigration to the European Union, and he joined us on the line from Warsaw. Hello, Witold.
Hi there.
Maybe to start, can you just set the story up and maybe, you know, at least give us your angle as to why you think it was chosen?
Yes, sure. The first thing I thought about was my friend, whose name was Yusuf. Yusuf was from Libya, and I met him like 10 years ago in very little hostel in Istanbul. I've been traveling to Turkey and I kept going there, and I wrote a book about Turkey, about many different things, its EU aspirations and things like that. And I kept coming back to Yusuf because he got a job in that hostel and we kept talking about his life, his plans. And his biggest dream was coming to Europe, and he thought about it and we talked about it a lot. But I didn't really believe he would try the boat way. The boat way means a very little boat, and the road goes between Turkish coast and Greek islands, and many people die on that road. And suddenly I got an email from Yusuf, and he wrote shortly, "I made it started." And he didn't write anything else, and I lost contact with him. So the first thought when I started was to find Yusuf. And I went to Turkey, and searching for him, I realized that this is a good idea to write, this is a good point to start an article and a research for an article about the illegal immigration to EU. Start with Yusuf, but write about the other people from all around the world, because they are from Asia, they are from Africa, and now they are trying to come to Europe from that direction.
And did this run as a feature in the foreign pages? Where did it sit within the newspaper, and was it even run as a serial, or was it just a single feature?
Yeah, well, it was printed once in Gazeta Wyborcza, and this was just like a short story, but it's also printed in my book about Turkey, which was just published a month ago in Poland. It's a book about Turkish EU aspirations, but right in a literary way. So that's where it can. But unfortunately, it's only in Polish.
From the perspective of the judges and the fact that you picked up the print award, I guess what did they tell you, and what do you think they saw in your story? Was this a piece that really in many ways encapsulated contemporary Europe, and also I guess the challenges that lie ahead as well?
I think because President Buzek said yesterday that the European Parliament is seeking for critical journalism. And that was my first feeling when I got that prize. This article was extremely critical. And it said a lot about Greek coast guards who are giving ropes to those immigrants and pulling them back to Greece or taking their things out of them. And it's also critical because it's very easy to talk about Europe, very easy to talk about immigrants when you sit on a comfortable chair in Brussels. But when you go to the coast and you start talking with people and you hear their stories, their situation in the coast is really horrible. What I think the jury found in my article is the distance and the difference between this comfortable chair in Brussels and this little boat between Turkey and Greece.
Mm. Vitold, I wanted to just ask you, has that made you something of, I guess, the house commentator then within the Gazeta, in Warsaw, that has immigration really become your patch now? And, in a way, you're almost the designated correspondent on this topic.
Well, I'm mostly covering Turkey and Middle East, and my second focus is former communist countries. So I wouldn't say immigration could be my focus now. I think I will stick to Turkey, as I've kept for many and many years. If there is something that really interests me is this is Turkish EU aspirations and its way to EU, and the moment, the very special moment, which this country is having now, which means that it's getting a real power, not only a regional power, but also a world power. And I'm very happy to be a journalist who can face the change in Turkey. It's governed by the so-called Islamic Party, but this Islamic Party is pushing this country to join EU, which they also in the same time they call EU the Christian Club, but they don't care, and they keep pushing the country to join the Christian Club. The Islamic Party is trying to do that. So that's amazing what's happening in Turkey right now.
Great. Well, congratulations on your win, Vitold Shabowski.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Brussels with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. It's probably not the most appropriate place to go to a boat show on the Mediterranean after Vitold's piece, but nevertheless, I think we have to, because we sent our Saul Taylor down to check out boats big and small.
Let's get our captain's hats on.
Okay, here's his monologue.
On Saturday, October the 2nd, the Salone Nautico di Genoa opened its docks in celebration of its 50th edition. Pictures of the first Genoa International Boat Show that took place on the 27th of January in 1962 are testament to the enduring success of Italian boat manufacturing, much of it concentrated in and around the Ligurian capital. Ladies in full-length fur coats and signori decked out in tailored jackets, tapered trousers and maritime paraphernalia sauntered the boardwalks inspecting the latest wooden vessels that floated together over 30,000 square metres across the city's marina. In its 50th incarnation, the Expo stretches out over 110,000 square metres, and that's just in the water. It's not counting the land-loving stands and the two giant pavilions. In 1962, the event attracted 430 exhibitors, 60% of whom were Italian, and this year there are 1,400 with a similar percentage of Italian-owned firms making up the numbers. One inconsistency in the comparison, however, is the number of admissions. This week, the final visitor count is expected to reach just over 250,000, down on last year's 285,000. In 1962, the event attracted over 300,000 rubberneckers. Back in those days, the boat show was a more democratic affair. Indeed, the boats weren't solely a plaything of the super rich. They also signified a very real way of life up and down the Mediterranean coastlines. This year, the leisure boat building industry has remained in hot water, and this was reflected in the marina at Genoa. In fact, the sparkling waters were yet another indicator that the industry is struggling. There were just too many empty berths, far more than in 2009, with only 500 boats exhibited in the port compared to last year's 570. Walking the 9 kilometres of walkways was less of a squeeze this year, and the faces of the PRs, dock bouncers and immaculate CEOs were more sullen than ever. Even the yard owners could be seen chasing after prospective clients with far more haste than they once would. Current industry pessimism aside, there was a strong showing from the stalwart exhibitors. The Ferretti Group were in their usual spot by the Ponte Restauro and had recycled last year's wooden cabin in which to hold press briefings and do a bit of client caressing. Of the brand, Mockycraft, Riva and Itamo with its new 75 sailor were the standout attractions. The news that Sorrento-based Fratelli Aprea was once again privately held by the founding families after a buyback from Ferretti Group was buzzing around the beautiful wooden Gozzo boats they build on the Amalfi Coast. And one manufacturer that hooked us in the sailing category was Southern Wind. Neapolitan owner Willie Persico hosted a dinner in the Rapallo Yacht Club a few kilometres south next to Portofino, where he was showing three of his company's splendid sail yachts. Back in the early 90s, Persico wanted to build a yacht for himself, but didn't have a yard in which to manufacture it. He chose a small builder in Cape Town that he eventually bought. Southern Wind now has a line of 11 models, from nippy 72s to formidable 120-footers that match Willie's playful personality. Most will have left Genoa with a heavy heart when they consider the state of the industry in general, but that weight should be buoyed by the rude health of the manufacturing sector and the clear quality that Italian manufacturers in particular are presenting. Things might be squally in the city, but it's on the water and in the yards where the industry seems to be preparing itself for a spot of plain sailing. For Monocle, I'm Saul Taylor.
That was our Saul Taylor in Genoa at the boat show. Andrew, do you want a boat for next summer?
Yes, please. Are you offering?
I might. I want a boat as well. I mean, you know that I'm very partial to that blue game that we had in Monocle Mediterranean. And the brochures have been sitting on my desk. Not that means anything.
Okay. But also that boat has been very good because actually when we've been showing that newspaper around the world, there's quite a few kind of CEOs.
Lots of oohs and ahs.
Yeah, oohs and ahs on that page.
I think we might have sold a few.
Yeah, so I think we need a commission.
Yeah, or at least they could loan us one maybe next summer. Anyway, I'm all up for sort of a blue game. It doesn't have to be big. I think 47 feet, something like that. That'll just a little med runabout next summer.
Yeah, as long as there's room for me on the back, I'm happy.
Yeah. So, end of the show. Any more thoughts on Brussels? Still, you know, peering out the window looking at real estate. No. I just wanted to check in because maybe you might have... I mean, I'm not that you're cool on the place, despite the weather today. But because I think, you know, I do like the look of the townhouses. Food's very good here. Airport is an absolute shocker. Train station needs a lot of work, but certainly well-positioned. Homicide rate, not great, though, when we've looked at the metrics before. I don't know who's getting bumped off here.
Assassins.
I don't know what it is, but it kind of maybe goes with sort of, you know, the political intrigue of the place. But that was one interesting thing, though, from our metrics. And it is one of the reasons, I think, when we looked at and we were shuffling the deck last year, is that that was one thing that actually stood out, given the scale and size of the population. Not that you're going to, you know, necessarily be threatened when you leave the studio, because it was actually an enormous motorcade. I think sort of the Ukrainians are still lingering around here.
Well, actually, when me and Alex arrived at the studios, there was some poor woman being bundled out of the building, and there were the police kind of dragging her down the street. We thought she'd probably been a very bad guest on a previous radio show.
Were they carrying her luggage?
She had a huge suitcase.
Oh.
And they were kind of like shoving her down the road.
I wish they could come back. Maybe they can carry mine before we have to go back to this very long walk that we have. Anyway, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills here at the European Parliament in Brussels. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our site. And also, and our November issue, is it your luggage? I was supposed to see it. I haven't even seen it yet. You do have it, don't you?
I do have it.
Okay, so as soon as we're off air, I'll be able to, we'll talk about it more next week.
Okay.
Very much looking forward to seeing it. Well, next week we're going to be back in London, but before that, it's a trip to Singapore and Melbourne and Sydney for me. Where are you going?
I'm going back to London.
All right. Well, I'll have tales of koalas and kangaroos when I get back. But for now, from Brussels, I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Andrew Tuck.
More next week.